Hey everyone, Scott here. Quick note before we begin this episode. This is the first in a multi-part series I'm doing called Age of Discovery 2.0. I make the argument that no decade transformed Western civilization like the 1490s. That's because before then, Europe was a continent split into factions, it was ripe for conquest, and hadn't made many significant advances in science or literature for a century, one could argue. But when Columbus returned and he brought with him news of his startling discovery, it fanned the dying embers of Europe back to life. Shipbuilding began at a furious rate. Trade routes to Africa, India, and China opened. At the same time, printing presses spread new ideas about science, religion, and technology across the continent. Well, I argue that today an Age of Discovery 2.0 is upon us. With Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and others promising affordable rockets to the moon and Mars within a decade, and essentially lowering the cost of this down to what it would cost to purchase a ticket on the Mayflower in the 1600s, one could argue that planetary bodies will be as accessible to humans as the New World was to adventurers in the 1500s. So what this series will do is look at the different ways that the Age of Discovery 2.0 will change our civilization the way the first one did 500 years ago. I mention all this as a prologue because I'm going to be doing a pretty long preamble about the influence of the first Age of Discovery. I don't want you to get lost in that. And then I'll mention all the great guests that will be joining me on this series, including Robert Zubrin, an American aerospace engineer, founder of the Mars Society in 1998, an international organization advocating a human mission to Mars as a goal by private funding if necessary. Also, Glenn Reynolds, a law professor at the University of Tennessee, who's written numerous books and articles on space law and policy and served as the executive vice president of the National Space Society. And Robert Zimmerman, who's written more than 100 magazine and newspaper articles on science and astronomy. All right, I hope you enjoy this episode. History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In 1931, the Rand McNally Company commissioned British historian John B. Sparks to produce perhaps one of the most ambitious projects the company had ever created. This would be a timeline that would map the ebb and flow of all of human history going back to 2000 BC, or at least the ebb and flow of global power. Well, he produced it, and it's a sight to behold. You can look at it online, and it's called the Histomap, or purchase it, and it's an infograph 12 inches wide and 5 feet long. The vertical y-axis shows the passage of time in 50-year increments, and on the x-axis, it shows the relative power of different empires or states. Beginning in 2000 BC, there are the Aegeans, which become Greeks and other Greek city-states over time, the Egyptians, the Hittites, the Amorites, which become Babylonians and Chaldeans, the Iranians, Indians, Huns, which become different Mongolian states, and the Chinese. Each of these empires are represented by a different color, and the width of these empires corresponds to their level of power. As you go down through time, some of these empires disappear, others are renamed. The Aegeans become the Mycenaeans and then the Greeks. Others become thinner, but never completely disappear over a nearly 4,000-year period, namely the Chinese. And you can see at different times that some empires basically take up the entire x-axis and seem to practically control the world, such as the Romans in 50 BC. Now, the map isn't perfect. It never quantifies exactly what power is, not linking it to, let's say, troop strength or total GDP. But from a 30,000 or 100,000 foot view, it gives you a good idea of what's happening in geopolitics throughout the ages. Now, something that sticks out with this map is it's surprising how little power regions that we think are very important in world history actually hold at different times. Particularly if you look at this map and go to about 1300 to 1400 AD, Europe has minuscule power. England, France, the Holy Roman Empire, Italy are almost nothing compared to the Ottomans, the Mongolians, the Ming Dynasty. And I would even argue that this map is giving too much power to these European states, which makes sense because it's produced in the early 20th century for a Western audience, so they would overemphasize this. Well, other historians have noted that the relative weakness of Europe was not lost on Europeans themselves at the time. In a 1942 biography of Christopher Columbus by Samuel Eliot Morison called Admiral of the Ocean Sea, here's how he characterizes the mood of Europe at the time. Most men were gloomy about the future. Europe appeared to be shrinking and dividing into hostile units as its sphere contracted. In 1453, the Ottomans conquered the Byzantine capital of Constantinople, had then conquered Hungary in 1526, and reached the gates of Vienna. This was after their conquest of Greece, Albania, and Serbia. Every 50 years, a different pope proclaimed a new crusade to reclaim these lands, but most Europeans ignored them because they assumed that the Vatican was simply trying to raise money by selling indulgences and enriching its coffers. Morrison says that the papacy hit bottom in the 1490s when Rodrigo Borgia, a corrupt ecclesiastical politician, was elected to the throne of St. Peter as Pope Alexander VI. The secular powers of Europe were no better. If you look at the Holy Roman Empire, the listless Emperor Frederick III was driven from his Austrian lands by the King of Hungary, and he retired to dabble in astrology and alchemy. His son Maximilian was full of promise but short in performance. In England, the Wars of the Roses were over, but few thought that the House of Tudor would last long. There was some life in the Iberian Peninsula, in Portugal and Castile, but these were on the periphery of Europe. Throughout Western Europe, there was a feeling of profound disillusion, that there was a golden age in the past, but it had passed, and there was a long twilight ahead for everyone. You can find this pessimistic mood in the Nuremberg Chronicle. One folio, dated July 12, 1493, states that it contains the events most worthy of notice from the beginning of the world to the calamity of our time. The chroniclers place 1493 in the sixth or second to last age of the world and leave six pages blank on which to record events from the date of the printing to judgment day. So at that time, they thought they were facing down the end of the world. Now, the relative weakness of Europe compared to the rest of the world wasn't the only reason that people had cause for pessimism. Medieval Europe was a mostly static society because all of the land was already claimed and all of the resources were owned. There was a ruling class that had been selected, and there were institutions, ideas, and customs that had been selected, and there was very little room for meritocracy. If you were born to a serf or merchant, it was very difficult to change your station in life, despite your hard work or your charisma or your talent. But behind the scenes, changes were already starting to happen, especially in the realm of long-distance travel and navigation. In 1415, Portugal captured the Moorish port of Ceuta in northern Morocco. This was a chokehold that prevented European explorers from safely venturing south. Henry the Navigator began sailing down Africa's western coast, searching for the source of the Western African gold trade. Portugal wanted to step beyond its status as a small rump state on the Iberian Peninsula, and Henry wanted to bypass Muslim territories of Africa and directly trade with Western Africa, hopefully finding Christian allies to the south and ideally accessing the rich spice trade of the Indies. At the time, trade in cloves, nutmeg, cinnamon, myrrh, frankincense, and pewter was monopolized by Arabs, Ottomans, and other intermediaries, which vastly inflated the prices before reaching Europe. Direct access to these markets would multiply the wealth of any European market who could reach them first. A small sack of spices in Western Europe could purchase you a house and years of financial security. After the mid-century invention of the caravel, which could sail safely on the open ocean, Portuguese navigators pushed even farther south on a regular basis. Senegal was reached in 1445, Cape Verde in 1446, Sierra Leone in 1460, and Sao Tome in 1471. In 1448, Bartolomé Dias rounded the southern tip of Africa, which proved wrong Ptolemy that the Indian Ocean was landlocked, and it opened up the Indian Ocean to European exploration. Well, in a way, all of that was a precursor to 1492. In the winter of that year, a Spanish caravel named Niña came into the port of Lisbon with news of a discovery that shocked Europe. This was, of course, Columbus's discovery of the New World, and it took a few years to sink in before European geographers realized that this wasn't merely a new island chain off of the Azores, but two entirely new continents. Morrison argues that in a few years, the mental picture completely changes in Europe. New ideas flare up throughout Italy, France, Germany, and the northern nations. Scholars are no longer looking wistfully at a golden age in the past, but imagining what's in store for the future. Christopher Columbus and other explorers are imagining expansion. Literacy rates explode. Gutenberg had already invented the first large-scale printing press, but now European kingdoms are setting up overseas colonies and they need a new bureaucracy to manage everything. So they need literate bureaucrats. By 1500, at least 500,000 books enter circulation, which range from everything from classical Greek texts to Columbus's account of the New World. Universities are being built across the continent. Small kingdoms set up enormous overseas empires, which double, triple, quintuple, or 10x their land holdings. England goes from being a small island off the coast of Europe, which was nearly conquered by the Spanish Armada in the 16th century, to the British Empire, which at its height covered 25% of the Earth's surface. Spain, Portugal, the Netherlands, and others control global commerce. Weapons technologies evolve, going from cannons to arquebuses to muskets to rifles, ships going from caravels to man-of-wars to frigates to steamships, which give Western Europe an enormous technological edge over its competitors in the centuries to come. Morrison thinks that above all, what reinvigorated Europe wasn't new wealth that came into the continent, or military power, or control of trade routes. It was the idea of limitless expansion and the idea that there was a frontier out there where anyone could go and make whatever they wanted of themselves. This idea was echoed by one of the most important historians in American history, Frederick Jackson Turner. Turner argued in 1893 that American democracy was formed by the American frontier. He says it didn't come from the imagination of the founding fathers, but it came out of the American forest and it gained new strength each time it touched a new frontier, leading to egalitarianism, a lack of interest in high culture, and violence. This allowed Americans to escape from European mindsets and old dysfunctional systems of aristocracies, established churches, and nobles or landed gentries. Turner presented this thesis only a couple of years after the U.S. Census Bureau announced that the American frontier was closed. The 1890 census said that the frontier line, a point beyond which the population density was less than 2 persons per square mile, no longer existed. Turner said that the frontier had produced the practicality, energy, and individualism of the American character. And here's a quote from him. "Behind institutions, behind constitutional forms of modifications, lie the vital forces that call these organs into life and shape them to meet changing conditions. The peculiarity of American institutions is the fact that they have been compelled to adapt themselves to the changes of an expanding people, to the changes involved in crossing a continent, in winning a wilderness, and in developing at each area of this progress out of the primitive economic and political conditions of the frontier into the complexity of city life." This idea of the frontier shaping the character of America was echoed by many other people. One of them was John F. Kennedy, who attended school when Frederick Jackson Turner's thesis was very popular. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. In a speech given to the Democratic Party in 1960, when he accepted their nomination to run for president, JFK said that pioneers gave up their safety, their comfort, and sometimes their lives to build up a new world here in the West. They were determined to make that new world strong and free, and to overcome its hazards and hardships to conquer the enemies that threaten from without and within. Now, like Turner, JFK mourned the loss of the frontier and worried that some might think that all battles have been won, that there's no longer a frontier. But then he pivoted and said that not all problems are solved and not all battles are won. And we, quote, "stand today on the edge of a new frontier, the frontier of the 1960s, a frontier of unknown opportunities and perils, a frontier of unfulfilled hopes and threats. There were uncharted areas of science and space, unsolved problems of peace and war, unconquered pockets of ignorance and prejudice, and unanswered questions of poverty and surplus." While in calling on Americans to conquer this frontier, this arguably led to such things as the formation of the Peace Corps, the space program, and the freedom marches and sit-ins of the civil rights movement. Well, thank you for sticking with me through that long prologue. And the reason I was doing all of that setup is because I wanted to drive home the point about how much the Age of Discovery fundamentally changed Europe and really global civilization, and how I think something very similar is going to happen soon in the next few decades that will have just as much, if not more, of an impact, and how a deep study into the past can tell us a lot about what is going to happen in the future. I was reading a book recently by Robert Zubrin called The Case for Space. Robert's a really smart guy. He's an aerospace engineer who was a junior chess champion back in the 1960s. He patented a 3-player chessboard at the age of 19, and he put together a plan for NASA in 1990 called the Mars Direct Plan, which is a proposal for a human mission to Mars that's cost-effective and possible with current technology. He's also the head of the Mars Society, an organization devoted to the colonization of Mars. Anyway, in his book, he made the point that in 1490, for example, it was impossible for anyone in the old world to travel to the new world. First of all, no one really knew it was there, unless we accept accounts and theories that, for example, Basque fishermen used the new world as their fishing grounds. But even in the early 1500s, after the discovery of the new world, it was nearly impossible because voyages were so infrequent, and it was about as hard to get to the new world as somebody becoming an astronaut today, of which there are only a few hundred who've been to low Earth orbit, or somebody going to the moon, of which there have been far fewer, and moon missions ended in the early 1970s. But in the 1500s, over the decades, as shipbuilding technology improved, astronomical tools improved, and sailors discovered how to use the trade winds properly, it became more feasible and much cheaper to go to the New World. Middle-class people, such as the Pilgrims, could pay their way for one-way passage to America by liquidating their homes and farms. Common artisans, without that much money, could pay their way by offering 7 years' work in the New World. Now, the point that Zubrin made in his book is that the costs of rocket launches are plummeting. From the Apollo to the Space Shuttle eras, it cost about $20,000 to put 1 kilogram into orbit. That's because rockets are destroyed or fall apart after they go up into the air and are just discarded. And if you flew on a plane that was destroyed after every flight, it would cost millions of dollars to fly too. But now reusable rocket technology is starting to be developed. Elon Musk's SpaceX can reuse about 60 to 70% of a rocket. And now the cost is about $2,000 per kilo to get into orbit. They're developing a next generation two-stage rocket that's fully reusable called Starship, which is being tested currently and will be available for government and commercial launches the next few years, that will lower the cost further to $200 a kilo and perhaps even $25 a kilo depending on how much it's reused. And Zubrin argued the point that in the foreseeable future, the cost to send somebody to Mars will be roughly equivalent for somebody to get a ticket on the Mayflower and go to the New World in the 1600s. All right, so with all of that in mind, I'm going to be launching a new mini-series on this podcast called Age of Discovery 2.0. What I'll be doing is interviewing a number of scholars, historians, and science journalists to compare the first age of discovery and ask the question, based on all the changes it brought to human civilization, what can we expect in the next few decades? Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Now, part of why I wanted to do this is that I've always been a space enthusiast from when I saw Cape Canaveral when I was in elementary school. When I grew up, I loved reading Golden Age sci-fi like Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, and Robert Heinlein. Now, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, okay, where is this going? This is a history podcast. Why do I care about any of this? One of the main things I try to do with this show is explore the idea that history is a laboratory of human experience. And what we're dealing with now or in the near-term future, if we look hard enough, we can find some sort of analog in the past. So for example, in one episode, I'll be talking with Robert Zubrin about the triangle trade in the Age of Discovery, in which manufactured goods were sent from Britain to the Americas, which sent food staples to the Indies, which sent cash crops back to England, and a new triangle trade could develop between Earth, Mars, and the asteroid belt. Furthermore, Zubrin discusses that in the same way that the New World broke the hierarchies of the Old World and the class system, having a new frontier will provide a similar kind of reinvigoration. I'll also be speaking with law professor and legal scholar Glenn Reynolds, who blogs at Instapundit, and he describes America's future in space, which will be dominated by the private sector rather than the work of government space agencies. And he'll discuss how, similar in the past when overseas exploration was taken over by private enterprise rather than government agencies, it led to all sorts of innovation, created the equivalent of trillions of dollars in wealth, and pumped incredible new energy into human civilization. Another thing I'll be exploring is risk and the possibility of death when it comes to discovery. Exploration and the establishment of new lands has always entailed risk to the health and lives of its explorers. For example, during Magellan's voyages, 90% of the crew died, and the willingness to take on risk is necessary as we push new frontiers. And on that end, I'll be speaking to aerospace engineer and science writer Rand Sinberg, author of the book Space is Not an Option, Overcoming the Feudal Obsession with Getting Everyone Back Alive that is killing our expansion into space. And lastly, I'll be exploring the topic of how settling new lands can either enhance human rights or it can make it much worse. In science fiction, you have utopian societies like Star Trek, where exploration has made humanity better and we live in a post-scarcity society where everyone has full equality. But then you also see dystopian science fiction like Blade Runner, where it's like a neo-feudal dystopia that makes use of slave labor. I'll be speaking with author Robert Zimmerman, who wrote a book called Conscious Choice, and he makes the argument that different American colonies had different levels of freedom depending on how they decided to set up their society. In New England, for example, slavery was vigorously rejected. The Puritans wanted nothing to do with this institution. Instead, they wanted to form a society of free religious family. Whereas in the Virginia colonies, slavery was openly embraced, resulting in a corrupt social order built on power, rule, and oppression, because money above all else was pursued at the expense of human rights. And there wasn't much there in the way of families or schools or any type of civic or religious institutions. Everything was built around money and profit. So as we push the frontier and build new societies, how do we build societies that embrace and protect human rights rather than societies that don't? And we see clear examples from history. I really enjoy putting together this series, and whether